When talk turns to war, someone will turn to Sun Tzu's Art of War, not just generals, philosophers, or historians. Tony Soprano has quoted from The Art of War, as have The Simpsons, Xena Warrior Princess, basketball coach Pat Riley, and baseball manager Dusty Baker. The 17 centuries old strategy manual for winning conflicts and avoiding them is still required reading in the service academies that educate soldiers, and probably in the camps of international terrorists and mobsters. It is also read in business schools and classics classes, who ponder the instruction contained in terse sentences that sometimes seem constructed like couplets. How a military comes to prevail. It is like throwing a grindstone against an egg. It is the empty and the solid. At a time in which Americans are debating the next stage in the war on terrorism, we're joined by Andrew Wilson, Associate Professor of Strategy and Policy at the U.S. Naval War College. He's working on a new translation of The Art of War, and Professor Wilson joins us from the studios of WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Scott. Glad to be here.
And you covered The Art of War in a seminar this week at the War College.
Yes, we did. We have the opening week of our course on strategy and policy begins with theory. The great theorists of war, Clausewitz, the 19th century Prussian, and Sun Tzu, the 5th century BC Chinese general.
Now you're going to say Sun Tzu because that's a different pronunciation. We should explain.
Well, that's the way that I pronounce it. That's the contemporary Mandarin Chinese pronunciation of the characters for Sun, which is his family name, and Tzu, which is master.
And at what point did military commanders in the West begin to consult this book?
Well, the first real appreciation for this text began after the First World War, when it seemed that the disasters and the massive attritional bloodshed that we saw in Flanders Fields, as it were, convinced many in Great Britain. The famous doctrinal theorist Basil Littlehart was fairly obsessed with this book as a guide for maneuver warfare to avoid the blunt, head-on destructiveness of the First World War, to come up with a new doctrine that relied on speed and maneuver and knowledge of the terrain and the adversary, so that one might achieve one's objectives as efficiently as possible.
Logic would suggest it was the Germans who read it first for the next World War, wasn't it?
It might seem that the Germans did read the text, or if they did not read it, intuitively grasped the lessons of speed and maneuver that the Germans ultimately capitalized on and used with such destructive force in the invasion of France in 1940.
Let me read a section that's early on. The military is a tau of deception. Thus, when able, manifest inability. When active, manifest inactivity. When near, manifest as far. When far, manifest as near. Thus, when he seeks advantage, lure him. When he is in chaos, take him. When he is substantial, prepare against him. When he is strong, avoid him. When he is wrathful, harass him. Attack where he is unprepared. Emerge where he does not expect it. Now, I must say, all of this kind of reminded me of Eddie Collins, the old Boston Red Sox player, who said the key to hitting was hit 'em where they ain't.
Exactly. It's that sort of pithy, aphoristic reading that the book often gets, that what we call fortune cookie philosophy, or in other cases, blinding glimpses of the obvious. But what's important about a passage like that is command is no longer a test of valor or romantic office. It's an intellectual enterprise.
It's not a book for war lovers, and I guess I wasn't prepared for that.
It is not. It's a book that essentially hits you over the head repeatedly with the costs and dangers of warfare. The
Yeah.
entire second chapter is sort of a price list for going to war. And also, by implication, it's a commodification of war that shows how the use of the military, and actually even the existence of the military in the first place, affects every level of society. That is not just an instrument to be toyed with lightly, that, in fact, when you send it out in the field, you are sending sons and daughters to die, and you might very well bankrupt your state in the process.
I gather it was one of the first known texts that really makes a case for spying and deception and active misinformation.
Absolutely.
As an
In
alternative
fact,
to clash of arms.
as an alternative or as a force multiplier when the clash of arms begins. And that's often a painful thing to swallow, that it's not the martial aristocrat, the valorous general that's most important in war. It's the lowly spy, often the crooked spy.
Struck by this section specifically, it says, moving the army, look out at the life ground and take a high position. Battle downhill, do not ascend. Now, is this what some U.S. and British commanders feared about getting involved in Afghanistan? And does this, in fact, help explain why al-Qaeda took refuge in the hills of Afghanistan?
Well, there's certain transcendent verities about terrain. Battling uphill is always bad. The strength in land warfare lies with the defense, in entrenched positions, in unfriendly terrain. It's very difficult to oust people from the caves of Tora Bora, for example, because to go on the offensive against a place like that would be disastrous and very costly.
We have a national debate, international debate to a degree right now, that's going on over the next stage for the United States in the war on terrorism, and a debate over whether or not that terrain ought to be Iraq. Is there succor for both or all sides of that debate in this text?
I was actually asked that question by a student at the War College. Is Saddam Hussein reading this book and getting worthwhile lessons from it, or is George W. Bush, Donald Rumsfeld reading it? My answer was that I hoped that our leaders are reading it and appreciating the lessons in it, that if we are going to act in the case of Iraq, that we have determined the value of the object in this particular conflict, and if so, we have calculated what we are willing to spend in terms of blood and treasure to achieve that object, and take very, very seriously that any attempt to oust someone from a defensive position, be it on a hillside or as a state, will often require a tremendous expenditure.
Professor Wilson, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Andrew Wilson teaches strategy at the U.S. Naval War College, speaking from the studios of WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island.